Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Bella, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop, Breast Cancer in Younger Women, New Treatment Options. And today's program is made possible through an independent grant from Merck and Company, Inc., and I really want to thank them for their support of today's program. Now, I just would like to let you know a few things about the program today. We have over 150 participants on this workshop today, and you come from all over the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities, and we also have international participants from Canada, the Philippines, and the United Kingdom, so it is truly a global call. And a credit to each of you that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us. And now it is my great pleasure to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Jennifer Matro. Dr. Matro is co-director of Breast Oncology, Fair Oaks, Innova, Shar Cancer Institute, Innova Health. And Dr. Matro will be addressing an overview of breast cancer in younger women, including diagnosing, staging, and ER, PR, and HER2 status, precision medicine, sequencing of treatment, what informs treatment decisions and options, genetic testing, including BRCA testing, understanding your pathology report, updates on clinical trials, how research increases treatment options, tools that help indicate what types of treatment are indicated, surgery, chemotherapy, and radiation treatments, and managing treatment side effects, symptoms, discomfort, and pain. It's now my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Matro.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. It's really my absolute pleasure to be here today speaking about this very important and increasingly, unfortunately, relevant topic of breast cancer in younger women. While breast cancer is most common in older women, it can and does affect younger individuals, and we are seeing an increase in diagnosis in younger patients, especially in their 30s and 40s, and even in as young as in their 20s. It's not entirely clear what is causing this increase in breast cancer among younger women. We're also seeing trends of increasing instances of colon cancer in young patients, too. This is an area of active investigation, but sort of bottom line is that the breast cancer is highly treatable, highly curable, particularly if the earliest it's found. And so when it comes to diagnosing and detecting breast cancer, we don't typically do mammograms for screening in women under the age of 40. And the main reason for that is that young women tend to have very much denser breasts, and so mammogram just doesn't pick up that much on a very dense breast. But young women, if they have a symptom or lump or something that would prompt evaluation, it's very similar to what we do for our older patients. We typically do start with a diagnostic mammogram. Almost always a young woman will also have an ultrasound as well, because an ultrasound is not a great screening tool, especially on its own, but can help in denser breast tissue to pick up things like cysts or masses that may not show up quite as well on a mammogram. When a cancer is suspected based on whatever imaging test has been done, then the next step is to do a biopsy. This is usually done as a core needle biopsy, and that's to obtain tissue so that we can confirm that it is cancer versus a benign condition like a fibroadenoma or a precancerous condition that would be treated differently than an invasive cancer. Many imaging sites are doing ultrasounds or imaging of the armpit area as well if there's a concerning enough finding in the breast, just to kind of screen and see if there's anything suspicious in any of those lymph nodes. And if there are, then a lymph node may be biopsied at the same time as the breast mass. Most young women should get an MRI of their breasts if they have a new diagnosis of breast cancer. And the reason we do that is because MRI is a bit better at picking up additional sites of cancer in dense breasts. So it can pick up maybe smaller areas that weren't seen on mammogram and give us a better sense of how advanced or how big the tumor is. MRI isn't perfect, though. It does have some downsides. The primary one is that because it's more sensitive and it picks up more things, it picks up more things that ultimately turn out not to be cancer. So it's not uncommon for patients to go in to get their MRI and the radiologist sees a few other areas that are indeterminate and they may recommend additional biopsies. And more often than not, those biopsies turn out to be benign, but in some cases we do find other areas of cancer. So it does lead to some increased anxiety and some additional testing, but particularly in young women where mammogram isn't as perfect, the benefits of sort of better characterizing the stage of the cancer is worth it, we think. And then once the cancer is diagnosed, staging determines the extent of the cancer. So staging is based on tumor size and lymph node involvement and whether the cancer has spread to other parts of the body. For the early stage cancers where it's just confined to the breast, we don't look head to toe with scans. The likelihood of us finding something is very, very low in the absence of any symptoms or blood test abnormalities, and we're more likely to find something that also leads to additional testing and uncertainty and anxiety. And so we generally don't recommend staging scans in smaller or earlier stage cancers, but if there is lymph node involvement or if it's a bigger tumor or any other clinical concern, like somebody's having a worrisome symptom, then we do order a scan, such as a CAT scan or a bone scan or a PET CT, just to make sure that the tumor hasn't spread beyond the breast and the lymph nodes. And then we also characterize the breast cancer. So breast cancer has three main subtypes, that's especially relevant for early stage breast cancer. And those are based off of the receptors that we look at. So there's the estrogen receptor, progesterone receptor, and HER2. So ER, PR, and HER2. ER and PR, when they're expressed on the cancer cells, they indicate what we call a hormone positive or hormone driven cancer. So the hormones that are naturally circulating in the woman's body feeds the cancer. And we know that by blocking estrogen, which I'll get into later in my portion of the talk, that's a very effective way of basically starving the cancer cells of the food that they use to grow. And then HER2 is a protein that is expressed on about 20% of breast cancers, and when it's there, it basically signals into the cell to keep dividing. So it's a marker of one of the more aggressive types of breast cancer, but because we have very effective medicines that target that HER2 protein specifically, it's actually one of the most treatable. And so 20, 25 years ago, where it was a very bad breast cancer to have, now it's actually one of the best breast cancers to have because the cure rates, the treatments are so much better. So based on those three receptors, we consider patients to be either hormone positive, so they're estrogen or progesterone positive and HER2 negative, they're HER2 or they're HER2 positive, and you can also be estrogen positive and HER2 positive, in which case you get all of the treatment options. And then if all three of those are negative, estrogen, progesterone, and HER2 are negative, that's what we call a triple negative breast cancer. And then the treatments and the way that we sequence the treatments depend on all of these things, the staging and the receptors. So triple negative breast cancers and HER2 positive breast cancers, almost all of them get chemotherapy. And most of them these days are getting chemotherapy before surgery. For hormone-positive breast cancer, it's not a guarantee that everybody needs chemotherapy, and I'll talk about sort of how we make that decision in a few minutes. So when now shifting into precision medicine and sequencing of treatments, what informs our treatment decisions? We don't, you know, we try not to use a one-size-fits-all approach. We're more and more utilizing sort of a precision medicine approach where we're tailoring the treatments to each individual's specific cancer and their presentation. Clinical trials are investigating how certain cancers differ from one another biologically and how we can predict which cancers will respond to certain treatments. So for example, some cancers are more immunologically active. One of the hallmarks of cancer is that they're quote, foreign cells or harmful cells that are just not recognized by our immune systems as foreign. And so our body just lets them grow out of control without our normal immune mechanisms kicking in like they would if there's a different pathogen, like a virus or a bacteria. But some cancers seem to activate the immune system a little bit more, and we can see that on the biopsy where the pathologists will comment if there's tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes is what they call it. And we've learned that cancers that have some of that immune activation typically respond better to medicines. Their risk generally is a little bit lower. And it has also helped inform our use of immunotherapy in certain patients, particularly the triple-negative population. And we are using different sequencing of treatments in order to escalate or de-escalate treatment. So, you know, historically we would start with surgery, and no matter how big the cancer was, you know, they'd do these radical mastectomies where they'd take the whole breast, they'd take part of the chest wall, they'd take all the lymph nodes, and then we would decide what to do in terms of medicine after that. But now more and more we're giving medicine before surgery to shrink the cancer, allow for smaller surgeries, breast conservation, maybe fewer lymph nodes to be removed, and then we can actually tailor the subsequent treatment to how the person responded. So whether you have a complete response to the preoperative medicine versus if there's still cancer there can impact how we might, what additional medications we might recommend. So the way that we decide, you know, specifically who gets what surgery or radiation or medicines is based on the extent of the cancer, the receptors, the patient's age, and individual preference does play a role. For example, most people don't need a bilateral mastectomy, but for a lot of young women, in order to get an optimal cosmetic outcome and sort of the best symmetry possible, removing both breasts may allow them to do that as opposed to removing just one breast or breast conservation and radiation to one breast. And so definitely personal choice comes in. Radiation is recommended for most people who get breast conservation surgery, and then anybody who has positive lymph nodes. And after a mastectomy, radiation is recommended if the tumor is big, if the lymph nodes are positive, or if there's a margin that can't be cleared. And it is important to know when deciding about reconstruction that radiation can affect the sort of appearance of a reconstruction. So radiation, you know, can cause, if somebody has had a mastectomy with an implant, it can cause kind of constricting or tightening of the implant. And so, that's something that when you meet with your surgeon and plastic surgeon as you're talking about what treatment options and surgery options are available to you, if you know you're going to need radiation, you may decide, you know, you may use that information to help decide, you know, maybe an implant isn't the best route. Maybe I want to do a flap reconstruction where they take tissue from your abdominal fat or your upper back muscle to recreate the breast. So those are all things that your treatment team can discuss with you, how the different surgery options and radiation needs sort of play with each other. And then the chemotherapy, so for triple negative breast cancer, because we don't have those targeted medicines, essentially everybody, unless you have the tiniest little tumor, is going to get chemotherapy. And we've had some data in the last several years that has established a newer, quite aggressive chemotherapy protocol that includes an immunotherapy called pembrolizumab in combination with our classic chemotherapy, and that has been shown to improve response rates when given before surgery and to improve long-term outcomes, reduce the risk of the cancer returning down the road. It is quite, you know, it's quite a tough treatment. All of your typical chemotherapy side effects that you may have ever heard of, plus with the immunotherapy, it adds some additional toxicities. And your treatment team is really here to help you through that. And then the HER2-positive cancers, all of them will get a medicine called Herceptin, and most will get a medicine called Perjeta in combination with chemotherapy. Many women, especially if they have tumors that are bigger than a centimeter and a half to 2 centimeters, will get their chemotherapy before surgery versus after surgery, so that we can use the response rate to determine, do we escalate to a different chemotherapy after surgery, or can we de-escalate to maybe just the Herceptin after surgery? And then finally, the estrogen and progesterone positive patients, many of them, particularly young women, because breast cancer in young women typically presents, just the biology is a bit more aggressive than we see with postmenopausal women. We believe that many young women benefit from chemotherapy who have ER-positive breast cancer. So many women get the chemotherapy, and then for sure there. And then we also basically induce menopause and sort of do a complete blockade of estrogen, so that we starve the cancer cells of the estrogen that they use to grow. And I wanted to take a minute here just to talk about sort of fertility options. I know Dr. Wortel is going to talk about this a bit as well in her section, but fertility obviously in young women is prime at forefront of mind. They're in their prime childbearing years. The chemotherapy that we give almost always induces menopause, which is usually just a temporary state. And if you're young enough, then your periods will resume after chemotherapy. But there is also data that shows that if we medically suppress your periods right as we're starting chemo, that we can kind of protect them. So we kind of put the ovaries to sleep. The chemotherapy doesn't affect them quite so much, and it makes it more likely that women will resume periods and be able to get pregnant after all of their breast cancer treatment is done. So we can protect ovarian function. Egg banking for young women is really, really important, especially if you're going to be getting chemotherapy. It's rare that the cancer is so aggressive, so, you know, that you need to start treatment tomorrow, that there isn't time to do egg banking. Most breast cancers, progress over the course of months, not usually weeks. And so definitely you should be referred to a fertility specialist to talk about your options. A course of egg banking takes about 2 to 3 weeks, and they generally get our patients with cancer in very quickly and expedite that process. And they use medicines to sort of protect from hormonal surges, so that we really don't see, you know, ER-positive cancers grow during the course of egg harvesting. And so definitely that should be a priority, because you really only have the option to do it once. So next, moving on to genetic testing, including BRCA testing in your pathology report, all young women basically should get genetic testing, no matter what your family history. If you're under the age of 50, you should get genetic testing, and that it's just sort of as simple as that. It informs your treatment options. It informs your family's risk of carrying the same mutation, and it can inform whether you would benefit from additional screening for other cancers or preventative surgeries, like having your ovaries removed by a certain age, or even having both your breasts removed to minimize your risk of future cancer. So genetic testing is critical and definitely recommended. And then as far as the pathology reports, I've sort of talked about most of the highlights. The most important thing is really the receptors that we pay attention to. And then quick updates on clinical trials. So everyone who's getting treated for cancer now is benefiting from clinical trials that have happened in the past, that patients took a chance on and enrolled on, and they're constant trials are constantly influencing and changing the way we treat breast cancer. And with breast cancer, because it is so common, our treatments are constantly evolving. So if you have an opportunity to enroll on a clinical trial, I strongly recommend that you consider that. And some examples of information or data that we've learned over the last few years is, you know, the benefit of chemotherapy in younger patients, premenopausal patients using Oncotype testing, whether they have 0, 1, 2, or 3 positive lymph nodes. There's an ongoing clinical trial called Offset that's looking to see, you know, do these young women who are premenopausal, the benefit that we're seeing when they get chemo, is it because the chemo is directly toxic to the cancer and is killing cancer cells? Or is it because chemotherapy, as I mentioned earlier, is suppresses the ovaries and basically induces menopause? And really, is it the menopause that's providing the benefit? And can then we just get that benefit without actually putting somebody through the side effects of chemo? So that's a really important study that's ongoing. And then a really great trial that came out a couple years ago is the POSITIVE trial that basically showed that it was safe, at least in the short term, to interrupt hormone therapy for up to 2 years after you've been on it for 18 months or more to get pregnant and have a baby. And we know that a lot of our young women in their 20s, 30s, and even early 40s, you know, if they haven't finished having their families, but they're going to be committed to 5 to 10 years of a hormone pill where you really can't get pregnant, it's the possibility of stopping therapy temporarily to allow for pregnancy has always been really intriguing to us. And we now have a study that shows that it is safe to do that, at least in the first couple years after interrupting treatment. It doesn't look like that increases the risk of the cancer returning. So that's something definitely to talk to your oncologist about. We don't yet know, you know, if it affects late recurrence risk just because the data is too young, but really very important for our young patients who are in their prime fertile years and still want to have a family. And then I'll finish up just briefly. So tools that help indicate what types of treatment, surgery, chemotherapy, and radiation treatments. I've talked about that a lot, sort of what we, how we decide who gets what in terms of radiation, chemotherapy, and the hormone medication. Most of what I've talked about is really restricted to early stage breast cancer. So just a quick note about metastatic breast cancer in young women. All of the same, you know, a lot of body image and stuff issues that Dr. Wortel may go into, but all of the treatments that are available for postmenopausal women and older women are available for younger women, and we treat them aggressively. We have new medicines that are constantly evolving. We have data on medicines like CDK4/6 inhibitors in combination with hormone therapy that have specifically been evaluated in premenopausal women and shown that adding a targeted pill to hormone therapy in stage 4 ER-positive breast cancer among premenopausal women makes them live longer, and so that's really important. Of course, all of breast cancer treatment has side effects, and managing those side effects is really a crucial part of breast cancer care. Chemotherapy can cause nausea, fatigue, hair loss. Radiation can cause skin irritation and fatigue. And then the hormone medication, you know, is putting a 30-something-year-old into menopause, and so they feel hot flashes. They can have mood changes. They just feel creepy and old. We in your oncology team have tools to help manage that and mitigate that. And they're not all just adding another prescription to, you know, to combat a side effect from another. That things like acupuncture can be really helpful. There's a lot of stuff that we can do. We have cold capping now for hair preservation. We have cryotherapy to help prevent neuropathy in the hands and feet. We have very effective medicines to prevent nausea. We have different medicines and interventions for pain management, not just narcotics, but non-narcotic pain medicine, acupuncture, you know, massage therapy, physical therapy. We use all of that to help address pain. The bottom line is that open communication with your healthcare team is really key. Don't hesitate to report side effects or discomfort that you're experiencing as you're going through treatment, because we want to know. Most of the time we can help. And just remember, you're not alone. There are a lot of resources and support systems available to help young women going through their breast cancer treatment. And your treatment team is here for you.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Major. That was just a wonderful presentation. And you are the first speaker, and so you really set the stage for today's program, giving people a lot of information, really stellar information. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you so much, as
sure.
always. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Asene Wortel, and Dr. Wortel is a psychologist. She's a Hartford Healthcare Clinical Health Psychologist, Hartford Healthcare Women's Health Services, member of the Health Psychology Department at the Institute of Living. And Dr. Wortel will be addressing unique issues for younger women living with breast cancer, quality of life, including sexual health, dating, pregnancy, and fertility issues, questions to ask your healthcare team, guidelines to prepare for telehealth, telemedicine appointments, including technology, prepared list of questions, and discussion of open notes. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Wortel.
Thank you, Dr. Messner and Dr. Matro, for that wonderful talk and all that rich information. I really appreciate everyone who's here today, and I'm honored to be invited to speak a little bit today about grief, quality of life, sexual health, fertility, dating, all these topics that probably don't come to mind first when you think of being diagnosed with cancer. And so before I jump into that, I want to share a little bit about what I do as a health psychologist. So a health psychologist, I did my PhD in psychology, I do therapy, I do research, I do assessment, but the real thing I do with patients is psychotherapy, thinking about how our physical health, our social health, and our emotional health all interact. And so as a health psychologist, I'm an integral part of my patient's medical team. I work alongside the physicians to help them think about how they're treating this individual person, but also how my patient can communicate with their providers to get the best care that they need. So for example, I have many patients maybe with trauma history or difficult experiences in their past that I talk to them about, you know, when you're going into this visit, how do you talk to your provider? How do you tell them what your triggers are so that you can have, you know, good conversations and feel safe in these environments while you're getting your care? So I will talk a little bit further about communicating with our team, but first I wanted to talk a little bit more about unique issues specifically for younger women, as Dr. Messner mentioned. So as we talk about breast cancer for younger women today, I want to start by discussing how we do not expect to get sick when we're young. Right? As Dr. Matro said, this is unfortunately a more and more common issue, but it's not something we expect. So psychologically, our first reaction is usually shock and maybe thinking, you know, this is not fair. And that's the most common thing I hear from my younger patients. Anger, frustration, sadness. It's not fair. It isn't. When we get a diagnosis like this, we start with that shock and then we have to grieve. We have to maybe go through periods of denial, disbelief. We may want to bargain. We may, as I said, feel angry or deeply sad. Those are the different stages of grief, and no one goes through them linearly. Those feelings may come and go, and it's all very important to acknowledge that when you get that diagnosis, it doesn't always filter in right away. It's hard to sit with. We have to kind of get through that in order to get our care. The other thing I see among patients is that when they're diagnosed, there's that urgency to rush to treatment. Dr. Matro mentioned that as she spoke about egg banking, that, you know, we have this, women I meet with will describe feeling like there's the cancer in them and it's disgusting and they want to get it out of them, and this very visceral reaction. And that's completely natural. That's understandable. And that urgency to rush treatment can lead us to not making time for focusing on our quality of life and our fertility or sexual health, all the things that we want to consider in survivorship once we've gotten through treatment. So if there's one thing you take away from today, is that I hope you can take that idea that Dr. Matro said too and take time and slow down.
if we slow down, we can take that time to grieve. We can consider the needs, what is the priority to you? Fertility, quality of life, or sexual health? To get into these topics a little bit more further, I want to share a little bit that, you know, when we're going into the oncology world and cancer world, patients and providers alike are often focused on curing or minimizing disease. That's the goal when you walk into that appointment at first, right, is to get rid of the cancer. These appointments are often very full and overwhelming and can be having a lot of important information, but can be difficult to process everything that's being said. When we're in that overwhelmed state, we don't really comprehend everything that's coming in, right? So you maybe walk out of an appointment and say, wow, I only remember 10% of what was said. So taking notes, having a person with you at these appointments can be really helpful because, again, the focus in that moment is to survive. Because that's the focus, there often isn't time to talk about sexual health, body image. How is this going to impact my relationship or even psychological health? Additionally, especially when it comes to things like sex, not all providers are comfortable with these topics. Patients may be embarrassed to ask or worried about their provider being comfortable with this topic or worried that there may not be anything they can do to help the problem. So, a study in 2020 showed that 72% of women with breast cancer said they were not adequately informed about side effects of treatment on their sexuality. This is a big issue. And fortunately, more and more studies and more conversations are being had about this in the, you know, among the medical professionals to realize we have to be talking about this more. But it still means that in these individual settings, as patients, you can advocate for yourself. You can bring up these questions, and I will talk a little bit about how you can do that today. So, again, that first step to slow down. Before any appointment, write down a list of questions. This might mean that you have to take some time to talk to friends or family or look at some blogs or other online resources. The National Breast Cancer Foundation has great questions. You make this list of questions and maybe even send it to your provider ahead of time, right, so that you know it's going to be asked. Broad questions can be helpful, like how will this impact my sexuality? Will this impact my fertility in the long run? Will I go through menopause? Will the menopause be permanent? Like Dr. Mitro was saying, there's likelihood that it will put you into menopause. What would that be like, right? Most of us don't know what menopause is even going to look like for us. A lot of families and women don't talk about menopause, and so we don't actually always know what that would even mean. So these conversations, I think starting the conversation by asking these questions and asking them often and early with your provider can be really helpful. As Dr. Mitro was saying, the impact of breast cancer treatment on sexuality or fertility really depends on the type of treatment used, the type and stage of the cancer, and of course the age of the patient. The most important thing is that you have these open communications. Your team can tailor your care to you and can hopefully anticipate with you some of the consequences that you may feel. Specifically regarding sexuality, you're going to want to ask about body image, vaginal dryness, potential changes to sensation, any pain you might anticipate. A 2022 study of breast cancer patients under hormonal treatment, for example, showed us that they have lower or absent sexual activity, lower desire, lower arousal, sometimes trouble with orgasm, higher distress related to sexuality, and that 70% of breast cancer patients report sexual concerns from treatment. So this is significant. Most women are having some sexual concerns. Again, something we don't often talk about during that initial treatment phase. And when I see patients in survivorship, that's when those issues are being addressed. it would be really great to have those conversations a little earlier to be able to anticipate what's happening. Dr. Maker also mentioned body image. That is a big concern for many of the patients I see. Most women in the U.S. particularly have trouble with body image already before going through something like breast cancer. Then to have something like a mastectomy or lumpectomy or to feel not safe in your body anymore. Research has shown that women with mastectomy often do have lower body image after surgery. There are ways to help mitigate this, like reconstruction, right? Wigs, when you have hair loss. I had a woman that I worked with recently who chose to shave her head on her own before treatment started to take ownership, to empower herself. These are things that could help with that body image. But it's having those conversations and getting support. Early conversations about fertility are also important. Fertility is something that is so different for everyone. And it needs to be a conversation of, you know, is this a priority for you? And if it wasn't, but now you have to make a decision, how can you get the social support you need to talk this through? Is that family, friends, a partner? Is it talking to a therapist, kind of having someone to talk through, you know, what you need to do in order to decide what's best for you in terms of egg freezing, you know, planning for your future? The National Breast Cancer Foundation has a great list of questions to ask your care team about fertility on the website. Again, the National Breast Cancer Foundation. And fertility, if you look that up, there's a great list of questions to use. As you go through this journey, as I just mentioned, you're going to need a lot of social support. And so seeing a therapist can be really helpful. I am a health psychologist. As I said, that means I am trained specifically to work in different medical settings to think about how our physical health impacts our social and our emotional health, and vice versa. Seeing a health psychologist during this process can be really helpful to process each step of the journey. The fears, the anxiety, the sadness, the anger, why me, right? Cognitive behavioral therapy can also be helpful. This is called CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy. Sometimes couples therapy could be helpful when your partner may be involved, and if it's around fertility issues, having a therapist to mediate these conversations in a couple setting could be helpful. If there's sexual health concerns, sex therapy is also an option. A sex therapist is a therapist who has special training in human sexuality and who can really help address the impact of menopause or chemotherapy or other cancer treatments on sexual functioning. That's desire, arousal, orgasm, pain, any of those issues. Therapy could also be about meaning making, coping with anxiety, as we said, learning how to meditate, being more in the moment. These are all things that could help improve your quality of life during this process. There are also many, many support groups, blogs, and other resources out there, like this Cancer Care Talk, right? There's so much out there, and I think social support can give you ideas or new things to try. I've heard a lot of different things about the cold capping and about all these different tools. Some people love it. Some people have different experiences, and so it's nice to hear that from people, right? Find someone who's been through it too. That way you can feel not alone and get some guidance on what might work best for you. This brings me to my last topic, which is communicating with your care team. The most important thing is to have a team you trust and that open communication. Whether you're in person or having virtual visits with your providers, you're going to get a lot more out of them if you prepare your questions ahead of time. Having that open communication, being honest with your team, not only will help you feel more prepared and help you feel more able to tackle the hard things that are to come, but will also help them be able to take better care of you. That maybe means that you have to admit that you're scared, right? That anxiety. the great thing about my work in oncology is that a lot of the providers understand that that's a normal part of this process, and they are there to help you. They can get you connected. This is why I'm in my field, in my work, in the medical setting, is to be there alongside the physicians to help the patients directly with their mental health, because this is not easy. So, again, if you're that open communication is going to help. And the other piece here is having that connection where you're communicating with your team. So you're going to have these visits, sometimes in person, sometimes virtual. When they're virtual, that's great, but you want to be there, you know, you want to be able to log in on time. I have many patients where we lose them the MyChart entry right as our visit starts, and it cuts into our time to be able to see each other. So, you know, preparing ahead of time, asking your cancer team, how do I get onto this virtual visit, and practice. The front desk staff are often helpful with that kind of thing. Also these days, we have this really great system of open notes. And I actually love the fact that my patients can see my notes in their chart. They can see what we've discussed, the goals we've set. The big downside of this is the anxiety that it causes, particularly when we get those results, right? Results without interpretation, without explanation by our doctor. Nowadays, patients can get the results before the physician has even seen these results. That being said, a lot of miscommunication happens. I'm not trained as a psychologist to read these results, right? So I may misunderstand what I'm reading. And a lot of my patients have those same strong reactions when seeing a result. Sometimes they misinterpret something as dangerous, negative, scary, bad, when later it's discussed with the physician and it turns out that whatever they saw that was concerning was not a concern. So I spend a lot of time with my patients talking about managing that anxiety. And one of the best ways to manage it, as crazy as it sounds, is to not look at your medical chart. To take time from it, to only look at it when you know you can see your care team. So if you're looking at it and then you know you have a visit with your doctor that day, that's great. But checking it on the weekend when you're not going to be able to talk to anyone for 2 or 3 days, that's going to cause more stress. So the best ideal is to wait for your physician to give you the results first so that they can give you the interpretation. I know the anxiety of not knowing is particularly strong in the world that we are in currently, where we're always connected. We want that immediate feedback. But the anxiety of misinterpreting a result is probably worse. And so thinking about that, I hope that we can kind of in summary, slow down, connect with social supports, make those lists of questions for yourself, and not check your medical record. These things are going to help you have a better quality of life as you're navigating this experience. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Wortel. That was just a fantastic, stellar presentation, and so much important information that you shared with everybody. I know there'll be lots of questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you so much. That's an excellent presentation. And our next speaker is Cassie Spector, and Cassie Spector is an oncology social worker at Cancer Care. She's our breast and gynecological cancers program coordinator at Cancer Care, and she'll be addressing practical and emotional coping tips, Cancer Care's free programs and services, and she'll be discussing Cancer Care's Hope Line and our website as well. Also, I should mention that any resource that we give during the program, you'll be getting a SurveyMonkey evaluation at the end of the program, and in that evaluation will be any of the resources that any of you have given during the program so that you'll be able to access that information. So I'm now going to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Spector.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. As mentioned, my name is Cassie Spector, and I'm an oncology social worker and the breast and gynecological cancers program coordinator at Cancer Care. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization providing free professional support services and information to help people manage the emotional, practical, and financial challenges of cancer. Our comprehensive services include resource navigation, counseling, support groups, educational workshops, publications, and limited financial assistance. There are many aspects of a breast cancer diagnosis that could be addressed through psychosocial supportive services, including making informed treatment decisions, quality of life concerns, fertility options, clinical trials, and communication with one's medical team or loved ones. A cancer diagnosis can be very overwhelming, especially for a young adult. Additional support and guidance, as well as establishing a supportive network, may help relieve feelings of anxiety related to one's diagnosis. It can be beneficial to determine ways to navigate feelings of uncertainty or isolation. Mindfulness practices such as meditation or journaling may also help manage feelings of worry or anxiety, as well as working one-on-one with an oncology social worker or a therapist through individual counseling can offer a space to express one's feelings, emotions, and concerns. Many hospitals, treatment centers, and nonprofit organizations offer supportive services. Being a member in a support group can also offer the opportunity to speak with others who are going through similar experiences, obtain information, and provide support. Currently, CancerCare offers several breast cancer-specific support groups online, including a breast cancer patient group, a breast cancer post-treatment survivorship group, and a metastatic breast cancer group. We also offer young adult-specific groups. So we offer a young adult patient group, a young adult caregiver support group. And although the young adult groups are not breast cancer specific, often we find that connecting with others around a similar age can provide a sense of community and support. The online support groups aim to reduce feelings of loneliness and anxiety, explore new ways of coping, increase feelings of empowerment, provide practical information about treatment and resources, and address ways to communicate with one's medical team and loved ones. Our online support groups take place using a password-protected message board format and are led by professional oncology social workers who offer support and guidance. Groups are held for 15 weeks at a time, and group members must register to join. You can register for an online support group through CancerCare's website, cancercare.org, by selecting our services and then support groups. After completing the registration process on our website, members can participate in the groups 24/7. Individuals may also experience practical and financial concerns throughout one's treatment. Please know if you're encountering such financial hardships, there are organizations that may be able to help. CancerCare offers resource navigation services that is a short-term, strength-based approach service for both patients and for caregivers affected by cancer nationally. A trained specialist will work with the client in connecting them with resources, referrals, and financial assistance. On CancerCare's website, cancercare.org, there's a wide array of reading material, information related to breast cancer and young adults facing breast cancer. This includes recorded Connect Education workshops, our podcast, Cancer Out Loud, the CancerCare podcast, publications, as well as stories of help and hope and resources. If you're interested in learning more about the support services we offer, I encourage you to call CancerCare's National Hopeline at 800-813-4673 to speak with one of our oncology social workers. At CancerCare, our oncology social workers are trained in how a breast cancer diagnosis can impact young adults as well as their loved ones. Remember, it's okay to ask for help and take time to care for yourself. It's been a pleasure to be part of this program. Thank you so much for your attention, and I'll now turn it back to Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Spector. That was an outstanding presentation and lots of resources for participants. And again, all that information will be shared in the SurveyMonkey that you'll be receiving after the program ends today. In about a week after the program, you'll get the SurveyMonkey evaluation. We're going to move into the Q&A, and I'm going to ask Bella to explain to everybody how to enter your online questions. Bella?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
Okay, and the first question is for Dr. for Dr. Matro. Why don't oncologists recommend a premenopausal triple negative patient refrain from getting pregnant until she's 5 years out from treatment? Does this recommendation vary if this triple negative patient had a pathologic complete response to chemo?
That's a really good question, and I think it basically just reflects what we know about when triple negative breast cancer tends to recur, which is in the first 3 to 5 years. So if it's going to recur, it's usually in that time frame. And if you get past 5 years, you're essentially cured. There are very, very low rates of recurrence beyond 5 years. I don't know that there's any specific data saying that somebody has to wait 5 years, but that may be the biggest concern of just the time period. But we do have data showing that once you've completed all of your treatment for breast cancer, it's safe to get pregnant. So, if somebody's had a pathologic complete response, that they're at the lowest risk of recurrence. So I don't know that you necessarily have to wait that 5 years. I think probably the oncologist is being overly cautious, because the worst thing in the world would be, to get pregnant and then also have a breast cancer recurrence at the same time. But getting pregnant itself does not increase your risk of recurrence.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And a question for Dr. Wortel. What are safe lubricant options for addressing vaginal dryness in ER/PR breast cancer patients?
That's a wonderful question, and I would say I always encourage my patients to talk to their oncologist. I have a lot of conversations with patients about moisturizers versus lubricants. Moisturizers, if there's dryness, a lot of my patients love coconut oil because they find it more natural as long as you're not allergic. It can be a really nice, it is a little messy, people say, so you can freeze it and then put it little balls and put it right up there or use it on the outside on the vulva. Otherwise, when we're thinking about, you can use coconut oil as a moisturizer or as a lubricant. When you're thinking about lubricants during sexual experiences, you want to think, do you prefer something that's silicone versus water-based? If you're using any toys or dilators or anything like that, you'd want to use water-based. So it really depends on the person's sensitivity. I always say take a lubricant and spot check it on your, inner arm or on your inner thigh and see how your body reacts. Give it a try. I recommend coconut oil. People who say slippery stuff is another one. Good clean love. Those are all ones that patients of mine have used and liked. But it's finding what works best for you.
Thank you so much. And another question from one of our participants for Dr. Matro. Are there recent studies on why ER-positive cancer returns despite surgical and chemical menopause? I was 28 when diagnosed with high ER-positive and was on Arimidex for 14 years when it returned to my chest wall. Again, high ER-positive.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, with all breast cancers, like any cancer, no matter how much treatment you give, the recurrence risk is not zero. We don't cure 100% of patients, and we do know that hormone-positive breast cancer can come back sometimes decades later. What we've learned is that sometimes cells just sort of hide out in the bone marrow or in the blood, but they're just sleeping. They're not actively dividing, and so they're not susceptible to the effects of our typical medicines like chemotherapy and hormone medicines, because they don't rely on the normal pathways to continue to generate new cells. And what it is that activates those cells to, 14 years later, start growing again somewhere else is not an area that we understand yet. It's an area of very active investigation, both to understand and to find, medicines that might better target those cells that basically are not currently, that aren't dividing during those many years that they're quiescent.
Thank you so much. And I'm going to ask our speakers to provide takeaways for our participants. So I'm going to start with Dr. Matro, if you'd like to just provide a takeaway for our participants on today's call.
Sure, yeah. We are seeing more and more breast cancers in younger women. And so, like I said during my portion, you're not alone. There are networks out there. Be cautious about what you take as sort of fact on social media and things like that. Go to verified sources like Cancer Care and cancer.org and places like this. But the bottom line for breast cancer is because it's so common, we have more and more and more treatment options. Even though more women are getting diagnosed, more of them are getting cured. So there's definitely reason to be hopeful.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And Dr. Wortel?
I will second that. I think hope is so important, and that's where having a good social support network, including family, friends, therapists, whoever else you can get, social workers in your team, obviously your care team themselves, any other physicians you like and work with, your social support team is going to help get you through this. Being prepared with your questions and being curious at where else you can find creative solutions, like Dr. Matro mentioned, in terms of acupuncture and all sorts of alternative options to help you get through this. So you're not alone.
Thank you so much. Thank you. And Ms. Spector.
Thank you. And I'd like to echo the same sentiments of really knowing that you're not alone. And we find a lot of times with young adults, if you're navigating young kids or you're navigating just a diagnosis at a young age, it might be harder to ask for help or find that support. And know that it's not a sign of weakness to ask for help and really reach out for support and be able to find what's going to be helpful for you, whether that's a support group, whether that's counseling, whether it's a combination of all the different supports. Know that there's options out there for you in terms of feeling connected and feeling less isolated.
And Ms. Spector, could you just comment on how one does join a support group, particularly an online support group?
Yeah, absolutely. So through Cancer Care, you would go onto Cancer Care's website, and we offer online message board groups, is what I mentioned before. And so you would go onto our website, cancercare.org, click on our services, and then you'll see online support groups listed. You'll see all the different groups that we offer. So like I said, we offer breast cancer specific groups. We also offer young adult specific groups. So you would click on one of the groups that you're interested in, complete a registration form. We would review it on our end. And then you would have access to that group 24/7. So it is a message board format, so you can log on whenever it's convenient for you and see other people's posts, post yourself. But if you're more so looking for maybe something in your area in terms of support groups, maybe you're looking for a Zoom group, reach out to your treatment team. See if they offer any type of support group. See if there's any local organizations that offer support groups. Or you can always call Cancer Care's Hope Line, too, and we're happy to point you in the right direction. If we don't offer something that you're looking for, then we can refer you to other organizations or other places that you can look into for support groups.
Thank you so much. Thank you. I want to thank our speakers. You've been phenomenal. And I also want to thank our participants. We've done this program before, but the questions this time were terrific. And although we weren't able to take all the questions, we took many of them. And I know for those of you who got to ask a question, we hope that that was helpful to you, but we also want you to go back to your treating healthcare team and ask them the same question you asked during this program. And also for those of you who are in queue and didn't get to ask a question, again, go back to your treating healthcare team and ask them your question. Remember, you've learned a lot from this program today, so when you ask your question, it'll be more informed, and you'll be asking your question in perhaps a different way, and you may get different answers. And please ask your question as often as you need to. Also, I just want to stress that, most of you have no difficulty reaching a healthcare team during the day, but evenings, weekends, and holidays present a particular challenge. And so we recommend that you all ask your healthcare team during the day, what is the best way to reach them on evenings, weekends, and holidays, because those seem to be the hardest time to reach people. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.